Born 1907 in Créteil, France, Jacques Barzin enjoyed an artistic upbringing. Barzin's father, a poet who claimed to have created simultaneous poetry, transformed the Barzin's Parisian home into a center of the emerging modernist art movement at the turn of the century. As a child, Barzin encountered the Cubist painters Gleize and Duchamp and the musician Varese. Marie Lorentzen painted his portrait, and the poet Apollinaire taught him to tell time on a watch. This artistic background laid the foundation for Barzin to become one of today's foremost scholars, teachers, and authors in the field of cultural history. During 1918, the horrors of World War I took their toll on a young Barzin, leading to depression. A change of surroundings was prescribed, and so Barzin's father, who had come to the United States on a diplomatic mission during the war, brought Barzin to America in 1920. Jacques Barzin enrolled at Columbia University in 1923, where he stayed as a student and later as a teacher for over 50 years. At Columbia, he found himself drawn to cultural history, a new branch in the study of history. He graduated at the head of his class in 1927 and shortly became an appointed lecturer in history. In 1932, he received his Ph.D. at Columbia and became a full professor in 1945, specializing in the field of cultural history of the modern period. Barzin strongly supported Columbia's newly created core curriculum program, a first in the nation. He saw the core curriculum in culture and humanities as an endless fight against the specialization of education at other universities. He believed the core curriculum was crucial in enlarging the vision of the students and developing their minds. Barzin served as dean at Columbia University from 1955 to 1967. He retired as a university professor in 1975. Barzin has published over 42 authored, edited, or translated titles on a broad array of subjects, including Darwin, Marx, Wagner, A Critique of a Heritage in 1941, Berlioz and the Romantic Century in 1950, The House of Intellect in 1959, and The American University in 1968. His indispensable guide, The Modern Researcher, has sold over 1 million copies. Barzin's latest work is From Dawn to Decadence, 500 Years of Western Cultural Life, 1500 to Present. This highly acclaimed work, which examines the religious, artistic, and social revolutions that shaped the last five centuries of Western culture, is the culmination to this point of over 80 years spent studying our cultural life. Barzin was twice president of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, a director of the Peabody Institute of Music and Art in Baltimore, and a director emeritus of the Council for Basic Education in Washington. Barzin is a member of the Society of American Historians, the American Philosophical Society, and the Académie Delphi in Grenoble, among others. He has received a gold medal for Belles Lettres and Criticism by the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Jacques Barzin is an inspiration for liberal education, especially through his courses at Columbia, and is one of America's foremost cultural historians. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a conversation with Jacques Barzin.
Jacques, you were born in France, spent your early years there. Why don't we begin by you telling us a bit about your early childhood and your family?
My parents' home was a center, one of the centers where some of the makers of the new 20th century culture was made. The Cubist painters and their counterparts in poetry and music and novel writing. As a child, my environment was, so to speak, poetry readings, music played at home, and endless discussions, which I didn't fully understand, among these young hotheads who were creating a new style. Until about the age of six or seven, I thought that the world consisted of artists and then a whole lot of other people who were service people, like lawyers, dentists, plumbers, and so forth. Art was at the top of the pyramid. I've changed my mind about that, but it was a great influence, and I think it had something to do with the fact that when I came to write history, I wanted it to be cultural history.
Mm-hmm. Well, First World War must have had an effect on life then.
Oh, yes, and a very damaging effect. Toward the end of it, in 1918, I fell quite gravely ill. Nobody could diagnose what it was, and I was in a state of depression. And apparently, I don't remember, I talked of suicide and things like that, because the endless experience of having people whom I knew reported dead, or seeing them come back, like the poet Apollinaire, completely shattered, shaken up, and soon to die, had got me into a state of disgust with life. That's what it was. I couldn't stand it anymore. And so I was taken out of school, and the very good family physician, very wise man, said, take him to a place where everything is new. So my mother took me to a resort on the English Channel, where everything was new, because vacations were generally spent in Grenoble in the Alps, where my family comes from, and where I would run into cousins and aunts and so on, and there would not be a new set of surroundings, and would not, I suppose, create both the curiosity and the shock of novelty. And after about 3 months, I recovered, and have never had any recurrence of depression.
How old were you then?
I was between 11 and 12.
Well, when you were 13, you certainly came someplace new. You came to America.
That's right.
What sort of impressions did you have when you first came here?
I hope this won't strike you as a high hat, but I felt in detail and also as a generality that this country was about 10 years behind the rest of the world. It was, in a way, confirmed, this impression, 10 years later, when the soldiers who had been to Europe went back to France, particularly, and acquired all sorts of habits and tastes, familiarity with modern art, for example, and came back to this country and brought up the country to that same cultural level, and the cultural lag, the gap, was closed and hasn't reopened ever since. I also got an impression that was strange. Everybody was extremely cordial and welcoming and warm immediately. One was invited to dinner by people one had recently met. Unthinkable in France. One does not penetrate the family until after a long period of probation.
You mentioned that in God's Country and Mine, but that egalitarianism, that openness, yes, to all, of course, has its downside as well as its upside. Something you brought out in an essay you wrote on conversation some time ago, that immediate openness also makes it difficult to have a real discussion, at least if there's an argument involved in it.
Well, that is true. I should have mentioned that. That was very noticeable, that conversation was, for the most part, chit-chat or gossip of a pleasant sort, and references to things that everybody knew. There was no digging into any question, pursuing an idea, because people might differ, and nobody contradicted anybody else. It was impossible, for example, to say that you didn't like a play that you had seen and that many people liked. That would be taken as a reflection on their judgment, their taste. And so one learned to be very careful.
I'd like to pursue this equality a little bit further, such an important feature of American life.
It's a difficult question because equality is not a uniform substance, so to speak. For example, the charge now of elitism suggests that equality has been in some way violated. But at the same time, there's a universal cry for excellence, particularly in schools. Now, those are incompatible aims, and so one has to learn where equality is required, and more particularly the forms, the words that are to be used to express equality.
You spent your entire academic career at Columbia University. Student there, professor, provost, and Columbia has some great names associated with it. Yourself, Lionel Trilling, Mark Van Dorn, Polycarp Cush. It was an institution that had a real, I was going to say a vibrant life, but then that would be redundant. It had a quality made up by all of those people together over a period of years. And there are other institutions, of course, that have had that in the past, Chicago for a while in political science and economics, Vanderbilt in literature, Yale in literature. But you see less and less of it today. Is that a loss, as it appears to me, or is the newer atmosphere with professors coming and going every 4 or 5 years, is that adding to the academic life?
Well, the shifting around of professors and programs and so on has been very damaging to the university. I shouldn't say much about the current university because I've been out of touch since 1975. But up to that point, one can distinguish two distinct periods. The one right after the war, when everything that you just mentioned was booming. Intellect, new programs, the influence of the post-war return of people who'd served, say, on the American committees for the peace making at Versailles. All those things were energizing in a way that lasted till about 1940. Then came the war, and after the war, the change in the character of the university, partly through the new habit of government support for programs and foundation support for programs, and the allegiance of the faculty turned from inside to outside. To be eminent, one had to have a grant, a project, filing cabinets, and secretaries. And that changed the character of the university until now it, well, now, until by the time that I left it, the individual professor was a kind of loose cannon, doing what he wanted and expecting his reward not from teaching or not even from standard scholarship, but from external activities, some of them very interesting and some of them very important, but still something quite different.
You've written that, at least as far as the humanities are concerned, for undergraduate education, there's no place for an elective curriculum.
That's right.
Now, that is, that's a charge I think would be disagreed with by a great number of people in the university world today. What's your argument for a curriculum laid out in advance for the student that they should take?
The school and the university were traditionally the carriers of tradition. telling the young where they were, how things came to be as they were, and suggesting difficulties and problems still to be settled. That seemed a fairly sensible program. And in order to carry it out, one has to learn history, literature, understand the language in its formation and present use, and plus acquire a knowledge of all the sciences and social sciences that one can in the short time, 4 years in the college and the preparation for those 4 years. Now, to turn that upside down and say that colleges and universities are there to instruct the young in how to reform society is an entirely different program. There might very well be colleges for that purpose, but then one would have to choose one's college. Not every young person, and certainly not every parent, wants to subsidize children to follow that very different program.
Well, if it was true in the past that you had the students on the one hand saying we want to take whatever we wish to take, and you had a faculty on the other that thought that all things being equal, it ought to be able to prescribe what students should learn, that has now changed so that the faculty seems to be much less united on the issue. If one raises in a faculty discussion this question, what ought an educated person be today? And what courses ought we to prescribe for students so that they become educated while they're here and while they're training towards their profession? I think it's very likely you would not get much agreement on that. What's happened to destroy the faculty's confidence in its ability to prescribe courses?
Well, one easy answer is that the faculties now are the product of that time of physical and intellectual rioting. And they have lost the idea of the university, as set forth, let us say, by Cardinal Newman in the book of that title, The Idea of a University. Another thing that has contributed to what you describe is that the lower schools have gradually given up their own mission to instruct. They want to educate, and that's a very different thing.
How so?
You instruct people in how to do things, and you cannot educate them. And an attempt to educate is bound to fail. Education is a process that goes on in the self, by the self, maybe with a little advice here and there, but with the elements that result from instruction, such as thinking straight, separating one thing from another, not being dazzled by formulas, ideas, ideas in quotation marks, those things that float around and are not really ideas, but just slogans or phrases. All that housekeeping of the mind has to be done in the lower schools through teaching arithmetic and composition and all the rest.
One great difference between college teaching and teaching at the pre-collegiate level is that college teachers do not receive an education at the hands of teachers' education schools. Those who teach in the K through 12 area do, of course. Now, without saying that all college teachers are good teachers by any means, it does lead to the question of, are we doing something wrong in our schools of teacher education? Is that part of the difficulty we face in trying to reform K through 12 education?
It's a very great problem, because born teachers are extremely few. I think they're fewer than born poets. And the proof of that assertion is very simple. You're a stranger in a town and you've lost your way. you ask the first person who comes along, man or woman, how to recover your path, and watch the kind of answer that you get. Perhaps one out of 50 will direct you in an intelligible way and really put you on the track. All the others, because you have to ask three or four before you really find your way, are potential teachers who don't know how to teach. That is the fundamental teaching situation. Now, given that fact of nature, we have to make tolerable teachers out of people who are not really gifted for it. And that requires a number of things. In the first place, persons with intellectual interests. A teacher, in a modest way, is an intellectual. In the second place, to obtain suitable material, you have to pay a good salary, not necessarily equal to that of a lawyer or a physician, but way up in the category of high professional people. And then comes the question, what special training should they get in order to teach? There is such a thing as pedagogy. It used to be a subject, and it deals with exactly the problems that I've indicated by the instance of asking your way when you've lost it. In addition to that, they must know subject matter, and the best way to prepare them in that department is to give them a liberal arts education. And then comes the final difficulty for us today. Where will they get a proper liberal arts education? Many of the leading universities and many of the leading colleges no longer provide it. They provide a pseudo-specialist education, which may be good or bad, but which is not a liberal arts education. Only some of the lesser-known colleges, colleges that would be considered in some quarters backward, do a good job in giving a liberal arts education.
In 1939, you wrote a book entitled Of Human Freedom. It's a theme you've written on many, many times. You've written about human freedom politically, its relation to tyranny, and you've written about it internally. But let me come back to the issue of tyranny for a minute. If there is a one large issue of our time that people have tended to take sides on and to have themselves counted on, it has been the issue of the Cold War, at least externally. And many, many academics either sided with the Soviet Union in that issue, or if they didn't side there, they tended to think that the issue was a draw, as it were, that there was a moral equivalence between what the United States stood for and what the Soviet Union stood for. And even prior to that, or not prior to it, but prior to World War II and the first year or two of it, certainly many academics in Germany supported the Nazis. So it's not clear that the track record of academics is very good when it comes to opposing tyranny. Why is that the case? One would think that of all groups, academics who depend on for their livelihood on freedom of inquiry and speech would be very much opposed to tyranny.
The issue is not posed as do you favor tyranny or not? And I think one has to understand the background of the dictatorships in order to pass judgment. That background was the feeling very strong in the last two decades of the 19th century and the first of the 20th, very strong feeling that society had gone adrift, that there were all sorts of small tyrannies, that the poor, the working people were exploited, that in the upper ranges of society, there was a social war going on between groups, the robber barons, the people who were for imperialism and exploited the colonies, dissatisfaction with society as a whole. And it reached such a point that it has been called by a very great modern historian, Fritz Stern, cultural despair. And that cultural despair opened the way to any number of, in quotation marks, solutions. One was fascism in Italy, the other was Nazism in Germany. And before that, it had been the Russian Revolution, which was, as you know, liberal at first and then turned into dictatorship. In other words, the feeling became quite strong that some stern measures had to be taken with Western civilization in order to make it live up to its own ideals. And the question was then for the Germans or the Russians or the French or people outside Europe, what is the price to be paid? And for a long time, the price was not written on the ticket. Many intelligent people believed that capitalism was a form of tyranny in itself, and that anything that substituted a better system was an improvement towards liberty and not towards tyranny. And it was only after the revelations of massacres in Russia on a large scale that disillusionment began to make headway.
Mm-hmm. You've also written about the internal aspects of freedom. You once wrote, "Democracy and freedom mirror nature." What did you mean by that?
I suppose I meant the chaos, the disorderliness that produces good results.
All right, it's not orderly, and there does seem to be a desire, perhaps I don't mean to limit this to the academic life at all, for order. It does relieve anxiety a great deal.
No doubt. The only difficulty, of course, is whose order? enforced by whom and how, and to what end. The idea of ends, anyway, is one that's compulsory. We have to have an aim, a mission, and we must work to fulfill it. But how we do it, and whether the end is good, is something that we only find out afterwards. So that we're perpetually in the state of disorder as we strive for order.
You mentioned in the book on freedom that the issue is the issue of absolutism and relativism. And interestingly enough, I say interesting because I think many people who hold your views on a variety of subjects might come down differently. You say it's relativism we should choose.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because in the book that I'm about to publish, I have a section on relativism, and I attack the notion held by many good people, worthy moralists and social critics, that relativism is the cause of all our troubles. There's a very simple answer to their contention. Whose absolutism are we going to accept instead of the relativism that they complain of? They attribute to relativism things that are not properly its fault. For example, they think that if you're a relativist, one thing is just as good as another, that a primitive culture is the equivalent of higher civilization. It doesn't follow at all. Relativism implies relation to something, to a standard, to a command, to an ideal, to anything that you want to name. All judgments are relative.
But people are very uncomfortable with that. Isn't it because they think that you are implying that there's nothing behind the opinion that stands on its own, that it is simply relative to your own view? And therefore, of two views of justice, let's say, which is the political question, what is justice? One answer is right, to people A, a different answer altogether is right for people B.
That's the history of morals all over the world. Morality is not the same everywhere. In Africa, having four wives is a sign of eminence. Here, it's a sign of criminality. Now, the question must be discussed. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily both right, but are they right in relation to X, Y, or Z? Where are we going to get the absolute standard? And I repeat my question, whose absolutism? Is it going to be Islamic, or Christian, or Buddhist?
But that's placing the question in a very different way, by starting with whose, because that starts with an authority, and it's just a matter of culture and authority. The older way was to say the Aristotelian way, there are N ways of discussing courage. There are N views of murder, N views of justice. Let's try to understand which is the true view. Is that simply a wrong way of approaching it? Is that going to lead to absolutism?
I don't know, but it seems to me that the way to discuss the question is by judging consequences. Even the Bible says that you shall judge them by their fruits, whatever they are, a principle, a people, a religion.
But doesn't that leave open the question of how you judge the fruits or the benefits? Or isn't that taken for granted somehow?
Yes, but you see, that's an infinite regress. You ask what's behind the thing being discussed. Where are we going to find a backstop?
Well, I suppose that's precisely the question. Is there no backstop?
Well, anybody who has access to the mind of God has the backstop. But whoever claims that is open to argument also.
All right, let me give a specific example.
Yes.
In this country, a decision was made that because of the principle of equality, slavery is a morally wrong thing. There are other countries still today that practice it. Is there any way of getting to the issue of whether it is or is not morally wrong? Or is that simply a matter of which culture one belongs to?
I think that puts the problem in a somewhat biased way, particularly because of the use of the word culture. We've got all of us used to saying that the culture is a determinant and so on, in relation to culture and so on. The intellectual argument must be based on something much more definite than this vague power we call culture. In relation to what is slavery to be judged? In other words, have we any other ideas, such as a conception of man as a human creature, which makes slavery absurd, horrible, injudicious, all sorts of consideration, not just a yardstick applied to the piece of cloth. And it is the compound of these relative judgments, half a dozen, 20, that ultimately determines in any society what is done and what is not done, whether prisoners are executed or imprisoned, or as it used to be among the Eskimos, that a murderer was simply asked to leave the tribe and he would go to another tribe where he was accepted without any questioning. That's one way to deal with murder. In early England, you paid a fine for murdering somebody. Murder is the name of a fine, not of a crime. So all these facts lead us to consider a great many more things than the yes or no of a moral question.
What is the problem that we face, whether it's in history, cultural studies, and public policy, with science? it seems as if it's going to take over every single aspect of life at some point.
You mean the incursion of science into all sorts of other subject matter?
Yes.
That is equivalent to the earlier culmination of religion with everything else. It is equivalent to our religion because it is thought to be the description of what is. And formerly, religion was the description of what is. So there's no keeping it out, except to object in particular cases that it's not applicable.
So the problem is that in claiming to reveal what is, whatever it doesn't reveal, isn't seen as a legitimate human possibility. And it does seem to be taking over in a certain sense. From the scientist standpoint, reality is whatever the scientist can see.
Yes, it is, yes. But it's not taking over. There's a growing resistance to what you described, and which has got the name of scientism. Scientism is the fallacy of thinking that science can settle every issue.
Do you think that's connected to the growth of all of the non-rational movements one sees and a reaction to the view that science must settle every issue?
Yes, the feeling is very strong that we have gone too far in the direction of not of rationality, but of rationalism, which is a different thing. The difference between reason with a capital R and reasoning with a small r and an ing at the end, which nobody wants to be against, at least I hope not.
Speaking of science leads me to a very different thing, and that's romanticism.
Ah.
You've said several things about romanticism that I think has changed our thinking about what it is. The romanticists have been blamed for things in this century, including even Nazism. I suppose because of the Nazis' like of myth and ancient history all fluffed up and so on. But you've claimed that that is not a legitimate lineage, that the romanticist ought to be understood on their own terms. Why don't you tell us a bit about the romantists?
What the romantists did is precisely what we were talking about before. They corrected the excessive rationalism of the 18th century. They said there is more to human life than these cut-and-dried propositions that the philosophe very properly deduced from their study of contemporary government and history and religion. Life is bigger than that, and they also pointed out that the cosmopolitan world of the 18th century was a very small part of the world. There were whole peoples who were not educated, who were not philosophes, who did not read the encyclopedie, and whose music and art and thought and action in history must be taken account of. And that is why the Romanticists were interested in the Middle Ages, in far eastern and southern places, and in every kind of individual expression. They've been accused on that account of being, on the one hand, egotistical because they were interested in the individual, and escapists because they were interested in the Middle Ages. And that is to misconceive entirely the purpose of taking in everything. It's not to escape, it's to enclose, to include. And that includes myth. And so anybody who's interested in myth is not necessarily a romanticist, and is certainly not necessarily an escapist. He's just interested in something other than his breakfast cereal.
It was in 1940, I think, you wrote that romanticism is a result of reason.
Yes.
Which came as a bit of a shock, because romanticism and reason have so often been paired as opposites.
No, it's a product of reasoning, as we were saying. Reason with a capital R had definite limits in the 18th century. Demestre, who was a romanticist of a rather crabbed kind, but still highly intelligent man, put it in one way. He said, I have gone all over the world, but I have never met man with a capital M. I've met Russians, Germans, Italians, and so forth. He said, I even have learned from Montesquieu that one can be a Persian, because Montesquieu had written a book called The Persian Letters. And that's a very good way to put it. You see, man is the abstraction. Is man, capital M, equals reason with a capital R. But men, meaning women too, and children, everybody, are a great, very colored mass of humanity.
You've written about a number of topics, but first and foremost, you're a historian, cultural historian.
Yes.
What brought you to that field? What sustained you in it?
One very early influence was my great-grandmother. She lived a couple of blocks from us in Paris, and on my way home from school, I would stop off at 4:30. She would give me a roll and a little piece of chocolate, and we would talk. And she was born in 1830, and I soon found out that I was very much interested in what she had to say about life in those days, what people wore, how they spoke, because the language had changed, some of the great events, things that she had seen, things that she'd heard from her family as she was herself a child. And I got very much interested in history, particularly in the course at the lycée where I was studying. And by the time I was 10, I wrote a history of France in 8 pages. And when my father rather gently asked me why it stopped with Joan of Arc, I indignantly replied, well, that's as far as the school has gone. And you see, I knew where to get my information ready-made.
Well, you have stayed with it. You've just completed a rather large manuscript. Why don't you tell us about your new book?
My forthcoming book is, in a sense, a summation of all that I've learned about the cultural history of Western civilization since 1500. What I've learned outside the accepted conventional ideas about persons, movements, causes and consequences.
Do you think there's any overall purpose to history?
Oh no, no indeed. the fallacy of the purpose of history is demonstrated in some interesting works called philosophies of history. Toynbee, Spengler, even St. Augustine, and many others along the way, Vico, who find an overriding tendency or an underground tendency pushing things along. And that seems to be so contrary to observation and recorded fact that I couldn't put a moment's trust in it.
Is that what you meant when you wrote that historical truths are built, not reached?
There's nothing ahead because, of course, you don't know the future, but also in the past, there's nothing to be reached totally as if it were made up. A history is a vision of the past, a selection by an informed mind, a mind which is strictly bound by fact and record and all sorts of evidence. To tell the truth as seen by the visioner. So that each history is a construct, perfectly reliable, which is why a person interested in history should read several histories of the same period, of the same movement, and form his own view, which is, of course, all that we can do as living beings. We do not see the totality of life, not even the totality of our own past life. but we have a vision of it with which we work and which is, in the main, reliable.
It sounds like one of your heroes that you haven't mentioned yet is William James.
Yes, quite right.
What is it that appeals to you so strongly about James? Well, I think you may just have mentioned it. His sense, perhaps, of the variety of nature and of experience.
Yes, variety and openness, possibility, and the sense that every object is many-sided. I like to think of the image of a mountain. Six people can report on a mountain perfectly correctly, but there's always another side, not to say two or three sides. And nobody can be on both sides at once and the same time.
Well, then your new book is A Side of the Mountain.
Yes.
And what's the title of it?
It's called From Dawn to Decadence.
Does the title capture the story?
Title suggests that our era is winding down in all sorts of ways, which is not something to get gloomy about. It happens in history over and over again, and recovery comes sooner or later. But certain forms, certain attitudes, literary, artistic traditions wear out. There's nothing more to do. That's quite evident in contemporary art and letters. And the ground has to be leveled flat before it can be built upon again.
In the arts, we can turn there for a moment. You mentioned that there doesn't seem to be anything new and vital to the arts. The artists themselves feel that everything's been done.
Yes.
And they seem to be flailing. What would be the sign of new life coming to the arts? How would one know that? We're always being told there's something new, but it doesn't seem to last for long.
If it were really new, we won't know what it is until it happens. It's unpredictable.
I'm wondering if there are signs, though. You have written that when eras turn, there is a sort of an expansion of the spirit. An artist and musicians and a desire to get on with things, and they work very hard. There's something calling them forward, they feel.
The experience has to be new. Then comes the vision of a particular artist who gathers around him supporters, imitators, amplifiers, and the culture has to be supportive. The other institutions, political, economic, and other, have to show signs of liveliness also. They cannot be in the stage of perpetual repair in which I think we are.
Let's take music, for example.
Yes.
There are those who claim that there's very little that's beautiful in contemporary classical music. Whether that be one's judgment or not, what does seem to be clear is that there has been a trend that avant-garde music, the new, whatever can startle, is the best. Yet at the same time, there have been a number of other artists continuing to compose, the Faurés of the world, and Vaughan Williams, and Korngold, any number, Schmidt, a number of people, continue to compose or have composed tonal music. Is there something really worthwhile in the type of music that's being displaced, or has everything really been done there?
Well, you've cited composers who are already pretty well inside the period before the decadence. The decadence began after 1920, when a man like Stravinsky, for example, who had been an innovator before the war, went back to the 18th century to find models and wrote a couple of suites in the manner of Pergolesi, showing disarray, loss of direction. Then music has taken two directions after that, like the other arts, like painting, for example. On the one hand, concentrating on the elements of music, say John Cage, hammering a piece of wood, or 4 minutes of total silence, suggesting that the noises in the audience is a kind of music. And on the other side, the passion for technique, high technicality, serial composition, which appeals to the eye much more than to the ear, and to which the public has remained totally deaf because it's hard to appreciate or enjoy. And perhaps the best exemplar, Webern, is limited to, for its total output, 2 small discs. So there's not a great deal of sap in that particular tree. And you could say the same thing about painting.
I was just going to ask you that about painting.
The elements of the art, just drawing squares and circles, or great bands of vibrating color with no particular shape. On the other hand, trying to be extremely adept technically, whether it's Dali in the academic manner, or the people who present you with highly complicated combinations of little circles and squares or triangles resembling a pattern much more than a painting. So all these spell dead ends, like Finnegan's Wake in literature. It may be a tour de force, but nobody is going to write another Finnegan's Wake or anything like it in form and technique.
Do you deal with these in your new book?
Oh yes, yes. My book tries to exhibit thought and art in the context of politics, economics, social thought, and cults of all kinds.
One older view of art certainly is that art, especially music, was a reflection of the soul, of a well-ordered soul. Or let me reverse that a well-ordered soul could be said to be a reflection of music and the mathematical world forms. Is there any sense in which one might argue today that there is a correct and an incorrect music?
Our Western scale is tampered with for the sake of modulation. The laws of physics and mathematics are defied in music, and music to mirror the soul, as you say, must be unmathematical, because we are not mathematical machines. We have mathematical ability, but we don't live by equations, although we embody rhythm. But we don't embody rhythm in any expressive way, except when we dance, and then that becomes an art, conscious.
How much of this represents new work? How much of bringing together of all of these strands that you've been writing on for so long?
Really, the preparation began when I was still in graduate school, though I didn't know that I was going to do this, or when. And the notes that I have used are those I took in school. Shortly after getting my PhD, I was offered a contract by a textbook publisher to write a cultural history of Western Europe since 1789, and I foolishly signed the contract. But I then, shortly after, went abroad to do some research in the Bibliothèque Nationale, where I paid a courtesy call on the director, who was a friend of my father's, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him my project. He raised his hands and he said, "Young man, I wouldn't do a thing like that if I were you." And I said, "Oh, why not?" He said, "All you will put down will be your present state of knowledge, which is necessarily incomplete, and you will copy from other books, and you will add your prejudices. And I said, well, at what point does one write a comprehensive history? He said, sometime after you reach your 80th year. And I thought that was a joke, but it turned out to be exactly what I did. In other words, I did preliminary studies of persons and periods and movements, and gradually the idea of a summa, a comprehensive survey, germed in my mind, and I thought, well, maybe I can do it. And I started about 6 years ago.
We live in a pretty fast-paced age, although one with certainly a taste for history. But why is history important? Why should it be important to those who don't think they have time to read in it?
History can be read for two reasons. I think that politicians and statesmen should read it for guidance, not because history repeats, but because there is, in any history written by anybody, a sense of how things go. And a sense of how things go is all important to the statesman. Churchill said this in different words. Abba Eban said it very definitely when criticizing the current way of teaching international relations and politics. So that's one reason. It's a practical one for practical people. But there's another one for the ordinary citizen. It's a wonderful change of scene. When one gets fed up with the world that one knows so thoroughly through one's day-to-day activities, reading history gives you a refreshment that sometimes you can't even get from going camping.
The title of your book speaks of decadence and decline. Where do you see us going on the important issues you have written on for the past half century in the arts, human responsibility, individual responsibility, freedom? Can you see much into the future?
No, only a little bit. And as an historian, I am precluded by my oath to the other guild members from prophesying. But inside every pattern maker of history, there is a prophet lurking. So I got around the difficulty by inserting at the end of my book a short 3-page description of the immediate future after this, attributing it to an anonymous author of the end of the 20th century. It's in quotation marks. Hmm.
But you're not going to reveal this to us.
As to what's in it?
Yes.
Oh, no, because if I were to speak what's in it, I would become the purveyor of that idea.
I see.
No prophecy.
Well, as you work towards completing the index on this, I expect you have another project in mind.
Not immediately. Like the French writer Paul Valéry, after a book is through with the index, je divorce. And the divorce from producing can last a long or a short time. What I should like to write sometime before I leave the scene is a children's story. Not necessarily historical, but conveying perhaps the sense of history without its involving actual people who lived in the past and attributing to them all sorts of wild ideas.
What has taken you in that direction?
Oh, I suppose getting a little weary of talking to adults.
Well, Jacques Barton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.